This is War News Radio. I'm Rachel Young. Here at Swarthmore, the War News Radio staff is back from winter break and back at work in the lodge. This week, we're taking a closer look at three of the stories that made headlines during the month while we were away. First up, Taiwan elected a new president earlier this month. What does this mean for the de facto nation's relations with China? Reporter Haruka Ono tells us more.
The people of Taiwan elected their first female president on January 16th. Tsai Ing-wen, chairwoman of the DPP, also known as the Democratic Progressive Party, won with 56% of the popular vote. She outcompeted her two opponents, Eric Chu of Kuomintang and James Song of the People First Party. She is the first woman to become president in Asia without any political legacy. Tsai is also one of the only two Democratic Progressive Party members to hold office. And on the same day of the presidential elections, her party also gained its first ever majority in parliament. Now, the DPP holds over half of the seats in the legislature. Her party is known for supporting Taiwanese independence from China. The de facto nation was marked by increased tension with the Chinese government under the previous DPP president, Chen Shui-bian. The DPP's stance comes in stark contrast with former Kuomintang chairman and current president, Ma Ying-jeou. Since 2008, Ma has signed 23 cross-strait pacts with China, and he was also the first Taiwanese president to officially meet with leaders of the Chinese government. On the other hand, Tsai refuses to endorse the 1992 consensus between Kuomintang and Beijing. This agreement vaguely defined Taiwan as a part of China, but did not cede control of the island to the Chinese government. Tsai's stance appeals to the growing number of Taiwanese people who do not see themselves as a part of China, particularly the youth. Over the last few decades, more and more students and young professionals have become vocal about their identity as Taiwanese. The Sunflower Movement reflects this trend. In 2014, thousands of people participated in demonstrations and sit-ins to voice their opposition to trade pacts with China. They were frustrated with current president Ma Ying-jeou's pro-Chinese policies. Since then, the grievances pit against Ma's Beijing-friendly government only increased, and Tsai's promise to protect Taiwan's sovereignty was especially appealing in this time. Following the will of the Taiwanese people, we will work toward maintaining the status quo for peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait in order to bring the greatest benefits and well-being to the Taiwanese people, Tsai said during her campaign. Despite her party's traditional leanings, Tsai may be a little different from her predecessor, Chen Shui-bian, a vocal supporter of Taiwan's independence. In her victory speech, she promised a predictable and stable relationship with China. Shelley Rigger, a professor of East Asian politics at Davidson College in North Carolina, said, "She has developed this complex and veiled way of speaking about cross-strait relations. It is a much more subtle position and allows for and actively invites interpretation." In addition to addressing Taiwan's relations with China, Tsai said she will also focus on a major concern of Taiwanese across generations, the slowing economy. In the last 8 years, President Ma Ying-jeou strengthened economic ties with China, and many are worried that his policies only benefited the upper class, aggravating the already widening income inequality. To improve the economy, Tsai promised to increase Taiwan's trade with the US, Japan, and Southeast Asian countries. In fact, her party has expressed hopes for Taiwan to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which does not include China. Speaking of China, Beijing's response to the recent elections has been quite quiet compared to previous ones. Lin Jiwen, a political scientist at Academia Sinica, a research institute in Taipei, said, "They have learned from past experience that shouting against the Taiwanese will backfire. Lin also said this means Chinese President Xi Jinping will be slow to put pressure on the DPP-dominant government. While Tsai has already won the elections, her term will not begin until May this year. We'll have to wait until then to see how Taiwan will change under her leadership.
In mid-January, a prisoner swap between the U.S. and Iran made headlines, raising questions about the future of diplomatic relations between the two nations. Sabrina Merrill brings us up to speed on the prisoner deal and what happens next.
The weekend of January 16th and 17th was historic for Iranian-U.S. relations. Following the nuclear agreement with Iran, where the U.S. agreed to lift economic sanctions in exchange for Iran reducing its nuclear program, the two countries also engaged in a prisoner swap. Iran released four U.S. citizens in exchange for the release of seven Iranians detained in the U.S. Praised as a sign of diplomacy success, questions still remain. What happened to one American noticeably missing from the release? Four dual national detainees were released from prison as part of the prisoner exchange, with Matthew Trevithick, an American, released separate from the exchange. Jason Rezaian, most notably, was the Washington Post's Iran bureau chief, held in prison in Tehran since July 2014, the longest incarceration for a Western journalist following the 1979 revolution. According to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry at a press conference in Vienna,
I'm very happy to say that as we speak, we have received confirmation that five Americans who had been unjustly detained in Iran have been released from custody, and they should be on their way home to their families before long.
The seven Iranians, six of whom are dual U.S.-Iranian citizens, were convicted or awaiting trial in the U.S. President Obama asserted that none of the prisoners were associated with terrorism-related offenses or violent crimes, with most being detained for violating the trade embargo against Iran.
These individuals were not charged with terrorism or any violent offenses. They're civilians, and their release is a one-time gesture to Iran, given the unique opportunity offered by this moment and the larger circumstances at play.
Each man was obligated to also forfeit his right to profit from any book or movie associated with the pardons and renounce any legal claims against the U.S. Notably, none of the released prisoners have plans to return to Iran, with most looking forward to returning to their daily lives in the U.S. While for many the news of a U.S.-Iranian prisoner swap seemed a surprise, it wasn't for some news agencies. After the release, the Huffington Post announced that in early fall, the reporter learned about secret negotiations between the U.S. and Iran over a prisoner swap. As much as journalists like to actively engage with the news they are covering, Huffington Post decided, quote, "We too would decline to publish a story that would cause serious harm to specific individuals unjustly held in Iran," end quote. Ultimately, Huffington Post drew the line between what the public needs to know and what would impact human lives, raising interesting questions about journalistic ethics. As the prisoner swap received extensive coverage by mainstream media, around the same time, the U.S. Treasury Department wired money to Iran in the sum of $1.7 billion U.S. dollars. The financial settlement resolved a 35-year legal battle over the purchase of U.S. arms by Iran's final monarch. The weapons were never delivered due to the Iranian Revolution of 1979. In a press conference, Obama announced,
"Iran will be returned its own funds, including appropriate interest, but much less than the amount Iran sought."
The White House framed the settlement as a win for taxpayers. The U.S. was expected to lose an arbitration ongoing at The Hague, resulting in greater financial liability. Amidst all the historic events, the prisoner swaps, the financial settlement, and the confirmation of the nuclear deal, one American slipped through the cracks. Robert Levinson, a former FBI agent and CIA consultant who vanished in Iran in 2007, was not a part of the prisoner swap. The U.S. administration insisted that they, quote, "have no reason to believe he's being held in Iran, so it's a different case," end quote. Beyond a hostage video and photographs from 5 years ago in an orange jumpsuit, there has been no public tips about his fate. According to the New York Times, in late 2011, a top Iranian diplomat, admitted that his country was holding the American and would free him if the U.S. helped delay an assessment criticizing Iran's nuclear activities. The ambiguities of the Robert Levitson case point to future challenges for U.S.-Iranian diplomatic transparency.
Finally, we turn the microphone a bit closer to home. Mexican drug trafficking kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was captured earlier this month. Anna Weber explores the significance of this arrest and the implications it raises for U.S. relations with Mexico.
On January 8th, Mexican military and police forces captured Joaquin Archivaldo Guzman Loera, a man you probably know better as El Chapo.
The notorious drug lord El Chapo, who escaped months ago.
El Chapo caught! The world's most notorious drug lord, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman.
The world's most wanted, most dangerous drug lord, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman.
He is one of the leaders of one of the most important cartel drugs in Mexico.
Guzman, nicknamed El Chapo, heads up the Sinaloa cartel, which is considered the most powerful drug trafficking organization in the world. In 2012, the New York Times described him as possibly the most wanted criminal in this post-Bin Laden world. So it's no wonder that Guzman's arrest earlier this month made such massive headlines. But what happens next? To understand El Chapo's rise to power and the implications of his latest capture, you should know a little about the Mexican drug war. In 2006, the Mexican government, under newly elected President Felipe Calderón, initiated military action toward drug trafficking organizations with the goal of breaking them down. The 10 years since then have yielded immense violence in Mexico, not only between competing cartels, but from the government as well. Many factors have compounded to make the Mexican drug war as long and violent as it's been. Pervasive poverty in Mexico and a dearth of government aid or employment opportunities drive many individuals to find work in criminal organizations. Collusion between Mexican government and military officials and leaders of drug cartels limits the effectiveness of these authorities in quashing these cartels' powers. And aid from the U.S. in the form of weapons, funds, and military personnel often funnels through these corrupt channels to ultimately aid the cartels. Not to mention the huge demand for illegal drugs, especially cocaine, in the United States. The occurrence of violence and the balance of power between cartels is always shifting. Power structures within cartels weaken and lead to collapse, renewing violence between existing cartels fighting for power and allowing new ones to emerge. Thomas Zerón, the director of the Criminal Investigation Agency in Mexico's Attorney General's office, says that since the beginning of the drug war in 2006, only two of the seven big cartels in Mexico are still operating and functioning. One of these is Guzmán's cartel, the Sinaloa cartel. Guzmán's capture falls in line with President Peña Nieto's kingpin strategy of targeting cartels' high-level leadership. This strategy tries to take down cartels by eliminating their leaders, driving the organizations into disorder and instability. But Sinaloa has stuck around for a while, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere soon. Guzman is not the only leader of the Sinaloa cartel. He is reported to have shared control with Ismael Zambada Garcia and possibly Juan José El Azul Esperagozoa Moreno, whom some believe to be dead. The important part here is that Sinaloa can survive in large part because it has a wide base for leadership and operates as a partnership with some of Mexico's top traffickers. Sinaloa has also branched out from its original cash crops, marijuana, and cocaine, into heroin and methamphetamine. With this business-style structure, it seems unlikely that Guzman's arrest will bring the downfall of his empire, especially because this isn't the first time that this narco folk hero has been caught. It's the third. In 2001, Guzman escaped from Puente Grande prison. He was smuggled out under the sheets of a laundry cart. A federal investigation led to the arrest of 71 prison employees, including the warden. After his second capture in 2014, Guzman escaped from the Altiplano maximum security prison in 2015. He slipped through an opening in his cell's shower section, made his way down a 30-foot ladder, and then traveled through a tunnel network that connected his cell to a house about a mile away. The intricacy of this escape suggests that Guzman paid off a lot of officials. After this escape, President Nieto declined requests by American officials to have Guzman extradited to the United States in 2014. he vowed that El Chapo wouldn't escape again. Guzman's arrest indicates the high stakes of institutional credibility to President Nieto's administration and the Mexican government as a whole. For Nieto, this arrest is a symbolic victory and indicator of governmental integrity. The police were not paid off this time, he can argue. The government caught El Chapo faster this time. The question remains whether El Chapo will be extradited to the United States. The U.S. has already filed extradition requests. With rampant government and military corruption as ripe sites for criminal exploitation in Mexico, U.S. officials argue that the only way to ensure the stripping of Guzman's power is to remove him from the country. Whether Guzman ends up in the United States or Mexico, we know for certain that the violence wreaked during the Mexican drug war will remain indelibly in the daily lives of Mexican citizens. Beyond capturing Guzman, there is still a lot more to do when it comes to establishing rule of law and the safety of civilians in Mexico.
Our show was produced this week by Catherine Kwok, Vanessa Meng, Sabrina Merrill, Haruka Ono, Anna Weber, and myself, with help from Neymat Kaur and Tyler Welsh. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about our program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter to keep up between shows and let us know what you think. I'm Rachel Young. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.